Thank you for tuning in. It's time for this week's episode of History's Hook with your host, Tom Price. Take it away, Tom.
Hello, and welcome to History's Hook, where I guarantee that we'll get you hooked on history. I'm your host, Tom Price. Each week on History's Hook, we'll be bringing you interesting and informative stories from the past in an effort to connect the history in our own backyard to the big events that compose national and world history. We'll explore a new topic every week and bring in experts and eyewitnesses to the events and places we'll be talking about. This is not your high school history class. We're going to make history fun and compelling. We're going to get you hooked. In today's episode, History's Hook will be unpacking a story 80 years in the making. It has all the elements of a best-selling novel, a story first set in the 1930s in rural Tennessee that tells of love, war, tragedy, loss, renewal, and rediscovery. Today, I'm joined remotely by two people who are integral to this story. Winder Heller is a native of Washington, D.C. and grew up outside of the district in Kensington, Maryland. His mother was a native of and grew up in Murray County, Tennessee, where History's Hook is located. And Mr. Heller spent childhood summers here before graduating from Vanderbilt University and Johns Hopkins University. He currently lives in and is joining us from Bethesda, Maryland. I'm also joined by Mr. John Whiteside. Mr. Whiteside was born in Columbia, Tennessee. During his teen years, his family moved to St. Louis, Missouri. He graduated from the University of Missouri and Missouri University. He's practiced law in Columbia, Missouri, since the early 1980s, and joins us from his home in Roachport, Missouri. Both Messrs. Whiteside and Heller consider their annual visits to Columbia, Tennessee, as a homecoming. Mr. Whiteside, Mr. Heller, welcome to History's Hook.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
Good morning, Tom.
We are going to start this story with an old Army trunk. In the Murray County Archives storage room is a wooden trunk. It's not ornate. It's a rectangular wooden box. It has iron enclosures and clasps painted green and stenciled in black letters on the top. It says Captain Joseph L. Whiteside. John Whiteside, that was your father's World War II trunk. Tell us a little about his service in the war.
My father was in ROTC at Auburn, and then when he graduated from Auburn, he went to work for Monsanto, which was how he eventually came to be in Columbia, Tennessee in 1938. After at the phosphorus, the elemental phosphorus plant located near Columbia. After Pearl Harbor, he actually had a deferment. His boss called him into his office, said, I have your deferment here because you work in a defense-related or necessary industry. And my father thought about it for, according to him, 3 seconds, turned it down and said, I'm going with all my friends. He ended up in Europe. After he originally worked on a shore battery in Massachusetts, then shortly after D-Day, his unit was sent to England, where they, according to him, learned to shoot some different kind of artillery piece, and then crossed over into France at Omaha Beach, actually, in September of 44. Then made their way through France, Belgium, Holland, became involved in the Battle of the Bulge, actually, and finished the war in Germany.
That's amazing. When did he meet your mother?
My mother graduated from the University of North Carolina. She actually spent 6 years going to school in North Carolina, 4 of them at St. Mary's in Raleigh and 2 at UNC. She graduated in 1940 and returned to Columbia, Tennessee, where she had a job eventually at Commerce Union Bank. My mother and father met one another sometime during that period. And at 927 West 7th Street, actually, Miss Carrie Williamson's boarding house, where my father and his friend Riley Broadwell lived. And my mother and her mother came to call on Miss Carrie. My father came down the steps and saw her.
Interesting. So we're talking before the war then. Just before the war. So your mother was Mary Jane Yeatman. Now, we should mention a little bit about the Yeatman family. They're important, I think, to Maury County's history. Your family goes back several generations here are connected to the Polk family. Our listeners are quite familiar with the Polks. You can't talk about Maury County, Tennessee, without crossing their path at some point in time. So tell us a little bit about your family and how they came to be in Tennessee, and we'll circle back to your mother here in just a minute.
The four sons, I think of William Polk, including my great-great-grandfather, Lucius Junius Polk, were the beneficiary of a gift from their father of a couple of thousand, maybe 2,500 acres each in Maury County, near what was at the time Ashwood, Missouri. And Rattle and Snap is one of the houses. I think that George Polk and his family lived there. Lucius Junius Polk and his family lived at Hamilton Place. And then there was Ashwood Hall, where I'm not sure, Leonidas maybe lived there, which is across the highway from St. John's Episcopal Church. The cemetery there is where my mother and father and all of mother's ancestors are buried.
It's an incredible place to visit. There's a real feeling of history, place of history, in that space. It's pretty incredible. So that's the family that your mother is born into. Lucius Polk, as you mentioned, was one of those brothers that first came here, I think, in the early 1830s. He became a Tennessee state legislator, I know, and was a major breeder of thoroughbred horses in his time. He was a well-known character and married Andrew Jackson's niece in the White House during the Jackson administration.
In 1832.
Pretty incredible. Pretty neat story. And all those folks are buried again at St. John's Church in Ashwood, Tennessee. So
we have the diamond from the wedding at the White House,
which I had a chance to take a look at. It's pretty incredible. You have the artifacts that you have from your family.
Right. We're keepers of things. I inherited that.
So your mother was sort of ensconced in Maury County here, growing up here as part of that family that could claim generations in this space. And you said she worked at Commerce Union Bank just prior to the war. What was her role there? Any idea what she did at that bank?
She was a teller.
She was a teller there.
Which would suit her perfectly.
let's shift gears for just a second. And our second guest, Winder Heller, you and I became acquainted because you were researching your family history that passes through Maury County and wanted to know more about a family member, Elijah Haynes Ayers III. Mr. Heller, tell us about the life of Haynes Ayers.
Yes. Haynes Ayers, born on April 24th, 1913 in Spring Hill, and grew up. Spring Hill today is a lot different than Spring Hill basically 100 years ago. In the 1920s, when he grew up, it was a mainly agricultural centerpiece community. And the train station is located about a mile from the center of the town at that point. And it was a rural, fair, cattle-oriented, bring the coal to up from the basement in the school building type of existence. He went to the military academy that was located right at Spring Hill, Branham and Hughes, and graduated in 1932, and then had an adventure. He went out to California by train to the Page Military Academy in Los Angeles, and was a sports director at the camp for a year, came back. Well, actually, while there, he took some classes at Santa Monica Community College and then enrolled at Vanderbilt, graduating in 1936. His grandfather had started the Spring Hill Bank in Spring Hill in 1902, and his father grew up as a banker, and he was destined to be a banker as well. So in 1936, he came to Columbia and started working at Commerce Union Bank.
So that's where our story converges. Tell our audience, how are you connected to Haynes Ayers?
My mother, it was the oldest of three children, and her younger brother was Haynes Ayers Jr. There was no thirds in the family, kind of strange. It was his grandfather was Elijah Haynes Ayers. His father was Elijah Haynes Ayers Jr. As soon as the grandfather died, he was called Elijah Haynes Ayers Jr. So there was never a third in the realm of possibility anywhere along the line. And my mother grew up in Spring Hill, always loved Spring Hill, and went to Central High School in Columbia, graduating in 1928, left, got married in 1934, and then never returned full time to Tennessee, but came back to Middle Tennessee literally every summer from 1942 until 1955 to Columbia. My older brothers essentially grew up in the summers in Columbia. I was too young to have those real memories, but it was always to us going home to come back to Middle Tennessee.
There is a photograph of Haynes Ayers that sort of floats around the internet. And if you think of the 1930s in our 21st century mindset, and you think of 1930s films, he was it. He was, he had Hollywood good looks. The photograph that you see, he is dressed up. He is debonair, drove a sports car. From what I understand, he had a pretty fancy car that he drove around. Highly educated, this young, successful, educated banker in Columbia, Tennessee. It's not surprising, John, that your mother might have taken an interest in Haynes Ayers.
Well, there's family lore, and actually, one time I saw a letter. It essentially said that mom and dad met sometime, probably 39, maybe 1939. I had Miss Carrie Williamson's house and became a couple and then broke up sometime. I mean, neither one of our, meaning I had two sisters, Martha and Devan, neither one of our parents ever talked about that period of time other than to give us the impression that they met one another and that was it. But I saw a letter when it was clear. And I think it was a letter that my grandmother sent to someone else, or it was in response to a letter that my grandmother sent to someone else. And in the letter, it said, "I'm so glad that Mary Jane is doing well now that she's moved on from Joe," or words to that effect. But neither one of our parents ever mentioned anything about any of that. And so mom and dad were an item. They broke up, apparently. And then mother, working at the bank, met Haynes. And very clearly from the letters that Winder has shared with us, they were a couple. When the war started, end of 41, early 42.
So Winder, you have some letters that mention Mary Jane. Tell us how that.
My family is very much like the Whiteside family, in that we save everything, and not as much in retrospect as I would like, for that matter. But I knew we had letters from Haynes Ayers, and let me just project ahead a little bit, because Haynes Ayers was a picture that was in the April, second week of April 1942 of the Columbia Herald Weekly. And it had the picture of these boys going off to war. And there was, give or take, about 45 or 50 men and right in front of the courthouse. And they were on their way to Chickamauga, Georgia, and that would have been Fort Oglethorpe, where they were to be inducted into the armed forces. Haynes, when after Pearl Harbor, tried to get in January and February to the Navy, an officer candidate school. His eyes were too weak and he couldn't be taken. So he decided that he would enlist, and then as enlistment, it would be easier to get into officer candidate school. So on April 7th, he enlisted at Fort Oglethorpe, and we have a letter that was dated April 8th, 1942. He wrote it to his mother. It says, "Dearest mother, wrote Mary Jane last night." First words he says were Mary Jane in this letter. He goes on to say, "and told her to tell Dad everything that happened. So I will start from this morning on April 8th. And so they were in constant communication throughout the next 8 or 9 months of his life. And we don't know, like John, exactly when this relationship started, but let's just say sometime probably in 1941. And they were certainly a couple in that Columbia social scene.
So we have an archival conundrum, right, where we have one family who has some indication based on family letters that John, your parents at some point were dating and then they weren't. And then we have a completely different family who has some letters that mention a Mary Jane, who is obviously close with Haynes' heirs. And so we don't have a connection. You two didn't know each other at this point in time as you're looking through these letters. And so all of this kind of comes together.
Absolutely not. I had no idea. I was trying to figure out who was Mary Jane. He goes on and mentions her a number of times. And then we have letters back that were saved in the 1942 time frame from both my mother and from my grandmother that mentioned saw Mary Jane at the bank. She looks lovely, things like that. He asked Mary Jane to send her some things he needed. In one letter, Mary Jane sent me these things. And so as the 1942 year went on, I had more and more Mary Jane connections, but not knowing who this person was. And I got involved with this because I'm project oriented. I love a project. And I knew I had these letters, and I wanted to transcribe them. And then let's see what we have. And then I've done that. And then I have had great fun annotating them. He mentions people. Who are these people he mentions? And so I started spending a lot of time with you, Tom, when I would come on my twice a year visits to Middle Tennessee. I would spend a morning or afternoon down at the archives. And one day I said, all right, this is the time to try to figure this Mary Jane out. And so I put Tom aside when he had a minute, and Michelle, the second in command at the archives, had said, guys, you know Columbia, and I've got a conundrum because I have a Mary Jane. I have no idea who she is. Can you help me? Right away, Tom Price said, well, I've known two Mary Janes over my 30-plus years connection with Columbia. And so we looked at the first one. She was too young. Wouldn't have been the right age at this time. And then he said, well, there's Mary Jane Yateman. And so we looked up Mary Jane Yateman, and then we certainly told a lot about her life. I love the story about University of North Carolina not taking women. You had to go to St. Mary's to get into North Carolina as a woman for your last 2 years. That was great. And then, but it didn't help me. And then I said, well, I think Michelle said, let's look at the Columbia, Tennessee phone directory from 1942. Phone directory is a wonderful resource. It not only gives a name of a person, a telephone number, it gives their address, what they do, and in addition to the phone number. And so we looked up Mary Jane Yateman, bingo, said clerk, Commerce Union Bank. So there was the connection that I needed to say, this is exactly whom this person was.
It was one of the most fun moments in my career as an archivist, and pure dumb luck. Let me not take any credit for any of this at all. When you said Mary Jane, I had the honor of knowing Mary Jane Whiteside. She was on my board when I worked at the President James K. Polk Museum. And so she was the first person that came to mind, but I thought, surely, you know, what are the odds? But to find that connection that both Haynes Ayers and Mary Jane Yeatman were working together at Commerce Union Bank in 1940-41 timeframe was a wonderful revelation. So we've connected these two folks, and we've connected the two families together too. This is a great time to stop. We need to take our first break. When we come back, we're going to learn a little bit more about Haynes Ayers and his time on the ship, the Dorchester. We'll be right back on History's Hook.
Don't go away. History's Hook with your host, Tom Price, will be right back after this brief commercial break.
At Columbia Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram Fiat, you can always count on us for a great selection of late model, low mileage, one owner vehicles. All have been thoroughly inspected and are ready to go. You can even save time and buy online with our online shopping tool. Looking to sell your vehicle? Great news! We're paying top dollar for your trade. All makes, all models, and in any condition. Trade in and trade up today. At Columbia Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram Fiat, you can count on us.
Hi, Terry Tillis from Tillis Jewelry. When you think of diamonds, what do you think of? Rare, precious, timeless, sparkles like the sun. They are timeless and nothing like them on earth. Then do you think, where do I buy local to buy the perfect ring? Maybe a diamond pendant or earrings or maybe a new diamond band. Look no further. Tillis Jewelry carries all your diamond and jewelry needs. Stop by and see our wonderful collection. And remember, if you don't know your diamonds, know your jeweler. Tillis Jewelry, downtown Columbia.
American Standard Heating and Air Conditioning is built to a higher standard, so you can focus on the problems in your life that actually matter, like the stair that only creaks when everyone else in the house is asleep. American Standard Heating and Air Conditioning, built to a higher standard.
Call Davis Heating and Cooling at 931-388-2090 for all your home comfort needs. Davis Heating and Cooling is your local American Standard dealer and proudly serves the Maury County area. Find Davis Heating and Cooling online and on Facebook or call today, 388-2090.
Are you thinking about a new fence? Maybe you need a pole barn. Then you should give Sands Fence Company a call. That's 931-309-1644. Will Sands has built his business based on the principles of honesty, quality, and integrity. Sands Fence Company has been in business for over 20 years, providing the community with farm, residential, and commercial fencing, as well as pole barns and buildings. Call today for a free estimate. Sands Fence Company, 931-309-1644. 931-309-1644.
This is Dr. Dominic Mancini from the Dr. Gill Center. Have you been injured in a car accident? Are you still in pain? Untreated whiplash injuries to the spine may lead to future conditions such as neck pain, low back pain, and headaches. The doctors at the Dr. Gill Center specialize in detecting and treating these conditions before they get worse. Our accident consultations are free. Call me, painfree.com, or call 615-551-9224.
History's Hook with your host, Tom Price, is back. Take it away, Tom.
Welcome back to History's Hook. Today, I'm joined remotely by Mr. Winder Heller, who lives in and is joining us from Bethesda, Maryland, and Mr. John Whiteside, who is joining us from Roachport, Missouri. And we are unpacking a big story, a story of love and tragedy during World War II. When we left off, we had connected your two families from the life of Mary Jane Yeatman, a young lady who grew up in Columbia, Tennessee, and was a clerk at one of the local banks, Commerce Union Bank, and connected her to Haynes Ayers, who is a young, well-educated banker. What was his role at Commerce Union Bank? Wonder
how he was also a teller.
Also a teller. The war is just getting underway, and as you have already mentioned, Winder, Haynes Ayers has enlisted into the Army. Do we know what his job was?
Yeah, let me just go back a second and say that I have scoured my family for letters, and I am happy that we have as many as we have, but there are more out there. And so I am always on the hunt to see if cousins have gone through their attics and have come up with anything. So we have a pretty good look at what his life was like during the war. as I indicated earlier, he was at Fort Oglethorpe literally for 3 days and then went to Shepherd Field in Wichita Falls, Texas for what I'll call a modified boot camp. And then he made a decision at that point to become a radio operator. This would be geared for the B-17s and the B-24s bombings over Europe.
So he's actually in the Army Air Corps. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's Army Air Corps that he went into. So he was then sent to Scott's Field right outside of St. Louis for a radio course. It's normally a six-month-plus course. With the war, they condensed it and made it about 4.5 months. And he became a radio operator. And the Monday to Friday, he was in class. He usually had the weekends off unless he had KP duty. And then graduating in September. And then there was an interesting time frame because from September till the time he actually shipped out, which was January 22nd, they probably didn't quite know what to do with him. They weren't ready for him yet, is probably the bottom line. And so he went to Jefferson Field, which was also Missouri, 36 miles away, and then up to Presque Isle, Maine. There was an air base up there. And then he was roughly 2 months at Jefferson Barracks and a month at Presque Isle, and then sent to Camp Miles Standish, which was in Taunton, Massachusetts, on January 22nd, took a train down from Camp Miles Standish to Staten Island, and at Pier 11 boarded the USAT, United States Army Transport, Dorchester. But before that, we get into the Dorchester. I wanted to just do another line or so out of some of his letters.
Oh, please.
He wrote a lot of letters home. He needed things. He wanted to know what other people were doing, etc. But one of those early letters, he says, have been in contact with boys from every walk of life. Have one boy sleeping close to me who spent 3 years in federal penitentiary. And I think he was enjoying this mix of people that he was experiencing. He was older when he went in. He was 28 at this point. And he probably became more of a leader. He was a private, but more of a leader under the privates. And they nicknamed him Father. And that was a nickname that extended throughout 1942, no matter what base that he was on. I want to go back on some Mary Jane comments. We will come back to another person shortly called Harriet Ayers, who was the younger sister to Haynes. And we know from letters that she was also a friend of Mary Jane's. Mm-hmm. And so in October 42, she sends a letter to Haynes. I haven't gotten to talk to Mary Jane but a minute. But the day you called home, Mother called her, and they had quite a chat about their boy, unquote. And so I think that to me exemplifies how close that relationship was and how close Mary Jane Yeatman had become to the Ayers family in Columbia, Tennessee.
That's amazing. So he, as you said, he boarded the Dorchester, which was formerly a luxury coastal liner of 5,649 tons, which had been converted to an armed army transport vessel. The ship was part of a three-ship convoy leaving Newfoundland, this is in January of 1943, and headed toward an American base in Greenland. It was escorted by the Coast Guard cutters Tampa, Escanaba, and Comanche. The ship was filled with 902 servicemen, merchant seamen, and civilian workers. Winder Heller, tell us what happened as the ship was heading east on the evening of February 2nd, 1943.
The Dorchester, in an earlier life, It was built in 1926. And it, as Tom, you've mentioned, it was a luxury liner going from Boston to Miami, continually stopping at seven or eight different places, Savannah, Charleston, Newport News, Providence, Rhode Island, etc. And after Pearl Harbor, it was requisitioned by the government, and it was no longer a luxury liner because it was stripped down and it was going to be an Army transport. And the pictures you see before and after are striking, for that matter. But the boys boarded, and they were roughly 904 men on. The exact number is always a little bit in question. And it left on the night of January 22nd in a 60-some ship convoy. And they stopped in St. John's, Newfoundland. They're part of the Lend-Lease program, meant that the United States got access to having a base in that region. And so they stopped there. They marched up to the base from early in the morning until night or late in the afternoon. We know this because he sent a V-gram, victory gram, from there. And then they boarded again, and that would have been on the 30th of January, and 29th of January. And they were now on a six-ship convoy that was called the SG-19. Then on the evening of February 2nd, 1943, even though you're up in the cold areas, the ship was quite hot, and the boilers made it insufferable to be inside. So the boys would want to be on deck as much as they could. Submarine activity was high. At that point, the captain instructed everyone to please sleep in your clothes with your life vest on. A lot of the boys didn't want to do the life vest on because they weren't comfortable, so that didn't happen. But on the early morning of February 3rd, 1943, at 12:55 a.m., the ship was hit by torpedoes. It was a three-salvo that was fired by U-boat 223. And what we know initially, we had thought that where Haynes was sleeping was where the torpedo hit. And so he may not have known anything about it, which went down with the ship. But after the war was over, a boy came into the Commerce Union Bank in Columbia, asked for Mr. Ayers, and it said, "Mr. Ayers, my name is Charles Cox, and I was with your son on the Dorchester." And that had to be a really hard time for the grandfather. Is the young man said, "If you'd like to know what's happened, that's the reason I've come to Middle Tennessee." So they went back up to West 7th Street, 410 West 7th Street, which is only a few blocks away. And with my grandmother there, he told the story of that night. And he said that although he wasn't with Haynes initially after the torpedo hit, he was on a raft, not a lifeboat. Not many lifeboats got away, but they did have rafts. He was on a raft, and Haynes was picked up on the raft out of the water. Now, this is the North Atlantic in February. You really have trouble living in the water more than a few minutes. And Haynes got on the life raft. He said that he led the boys on the raft singing some hymns, and then he let out a large cry and died. He had a hypothermia-induced heart attack and immediately was gone. And it was good for closure, but it's hard to hear exactly what happened. Now, the ship itself was hit. 12:55, it was under the water at 1:20. So 25 minutes is all it took for that ship to go down.
It's an amazing story, and we're gonna talk more about this. I wanted to flesh out what the night was like. On the night that it was hit by the torpedo, it was an exceedingly calm, clear, and dark night in the North Atlantic, yes, which is a fair rarity. There was no moon. There were no stars that night. The ship, as you said, was known to be in a dangerous corridor. It's actually called Torpedo Junction, and they had had word that a German U-boat was actually trailing this six-ship convoy. So as you said, the captain let everybody on board know that that was the case, and that everybody needed to sleep in their clothing and in their life jackets as well. The ship captain's name was a merchant marine captain. Hans Danielson was his name. The army complement was commanded by Captain Preston Krecker. The U-boat that was following them, as you said, U-223, was commanded by a 26-year-old Lieutenant Commander Carl Jürg Wachter. Or Wachter, I suppose it's pronounced. It was their maiden voyage, and they were part of a wolf pack. The German submarines then operated in multiple numbers at that point in time, but this particular submarine was on the trail of this convoy. It had already been attacked earlier in the day and was forced to submerge by the cutters that were escorting the Dorchester and the two other ships. Along with her. And that night, she now sailed on the surface, nearly impossible to see in the darkness. A submarine has a very low silhouette on the ocean surface. The convoy, on the other hand, was very loud and visible in the night. That although it was a dark night, at least one of the ships in the convoy was coal burning, which gave off a huge amount of smoke. Pretty easy to see even in the silhouette of this exceedingly dark night. The captain actually mentioned to the crew that by way of assurance, I suppose, that if they made it through the night, if they survived the night, they would be under air cover from Blue West 1, which was the air base in Greenland. So to, I think, the captain's mind, at least, if they could just get through the night, they would be okay. They'd make it to their destination. Yeah. Aboard the U-boat was torpedo man Eric Posler, who prepared to fire that three torpedo salvo that you mentioned. And within minutes, those three deadly fish were in the water, headed toward the shadow, creeping past at a distance of about 1,000 yards when they made that shot. He had the perfect lineup. If any of our listeners know anything about submarine warfare, you need to be at a certain angle, hopefully going at a certain speed. You had to understand the angle of the enemy's ship, the rate of speed in which they were going, the type of ship they had, so they could understand how deep they were below the waterline. All of that math has to go into making a successful shot. He had the perfect lineup on that very dark night. On board that night was a first sergeant named Michael Warish, who is making his rounds on the deck. And as he checked his watch at 12:55, as you said, he felt the ship shudder and heard a muffled explosion as the torpedo slammed into the starboard side of the Dorchester well below the waterline. It was kind of an unusual thing. Most people didn't hear a massive explosion. They felt the ship first, and there was sort of a muffled sound. It concerned them, but the ship listed hard to the right almost immediately, about a 30-degree list to the right. The lights went out. Steam pipes split. Bunks collapsed like cards, one on top of another. The sounds of screaming, the smell of gunpowder, and ammonia filled the air. The initial explosion killed dozens outright, and a wave of cold water entered the ship, quickly drowning dozens more. Nearly one-third of those aboard died in the first moments of that disaster. And as you said, just 25 minutes later, the ship had sunk under the wave. So all 900 or so people on board were in the water, either dead in the water, swimming in the water as best they could, or in life rafts or boats trying to escape the disaster. The water, I found an official report written after the disaster. They estimated the water was about 33 degrees that night, the air temperature about 36. So the odds of living very long in that water were not good. Many of the lifeboats had been destroyed in the initial blast. Others were unusable due to the extreme list of the ship. They couldn't come off the davits. Some others were frozen in their davits as well. In a war that saw horrific casualties, the story of the Dorchester might have gone relatively unnoticed, except the loss of this ship saw some incredible acts of heroism, and the ship and its story became quite famous. Winder, can you take up the story of the four chaplains? Do you know much about them?
Sure. Yeah, a little bit anyway. So you have this massive chaos. And the story goes that as the servicemen would come up to the decks to get hopefully into a lifeboat, where there are no lifeboats to be had, many did not have life vests. And so there were lockers up there that held life vests, but they ran out of numbers, given the number of men coming up without their own life vest on. So the four chaplains were on board, two Protestants, a rabbi, and a Catholic priest. And this is collaborated by many accounts. They took off the life vest they had on and gave it to to servicemen, and who then jumped into the water, and they themselves went down with the ship, linking arms together is what you hear anyway. And so the story of the four chaplains, or the also called the immortal chaplains, came right down from that point on. In 1948, the United States put out a 3 cents postage stamp commemorating the four chaplains. There are a number of places. Temple University has a chapel to the four chaplains. Dorchester, Wisconsin has a little monument there to the four chaplains. But it's a wonderful story in the midst of a huge disaster. Give or take, 675 men lost their lives on the Dorchester.
I'd like to mention the four chaplains by name. Lieutenant George L. Fox, a Methodist minister. Lieutenant Alexander D. Goode was a Jewish rabbi. Lieutenant John P. Washington, a Roman Catholic priest. And Lieutenant Clark V. Poling, a minister in the Dutch Reformed Church. An amazing story of selflessness and sacrifice for others. As you said, gave up their own life preservers. There's one account where a soldier came up and in not in much panic realized that he had forgotten his gloves and was about to go back down into the lower decks to retrieve them. And I think it was the Catholic priest, Father Washington, who said, "Here, take mine. I have two pairs." And it was only later, after the survivor thought about it, realized that, of course, he didn't have two pairs. He just gave me his gloves, knowing that he wasn't going to get off the ship himself. So it is an absolutely an amazing story of heroism in a really terrible moment in time. We need to take our second break. When we come back, we're going to spend a little bit more time on the four chaplains, talk about the aftermath of the disaster, and come back to our story of Haynes Ayres and Mary Jane. We'll be right back on History's Hook.
Don't go away. History's Hook with your host, Tom Price, will be right back after this brief commercial break.
Hi, I'm Robert Rogers at Parks Motor Sales Buick GMC. Parks Motor Sales was founded by my granddad, Bobby Parks, and my great-granddad, Julian Mays, in 1958. We've been family-owned the whole time, and being family-owned, locally-owned, means you get to get your next vehicle or your existing vehicle serviced by the same people who stand in the grocery line with you, drop their kids off at the same school you do, and smile and are happy to see you when they do. So come see us at Parks Motor Sales in Columbia, Tennessee on 919 Nashville Highway or parksmotorsales.com.
I'm Barbara Lincoln with Holland's Pharmacy. We have advertised with WKRM and WKOM for the past several years and found it to be very successful. I highly recommend advertising with them if you have a local business like ours. We're located at 1608 Hatcher Lane here in Columbia. We're open Monday through Friday from 8 to 6 and Saturdays from 8 to 2. Stop by Holland's for all your prescription needs, where we have fast, friendly, courteous service. We custom fit support hose for you also. Thanks for supporting Holland's and WKRM and WKOM.
Hi, I'm Steve, the garbage man. Are you new to Maury County? We want to welcome you and your family. We are a local residential garbage service, and we want to be your garbage man. We've been around for over 30 years, so we have a reputation. Check us out at garbagemaninc.com or call Mike at 931-540-0919. You could also ask your neighbor. 931-540-0919.
For 40 years, the Jewelers Bench has worked hard for their customers and provided the highest quality jewelry at the best price. They keep going back. Recent renovations have allowed them to expand their inventory. More high-quality jewelry, custom vintage and estate pieces, and professional jewelry and watch repairs. They also buy gold. The Jewelers Bench, still here, still great service. 808 Trotwood Avenue, Columbia. History's Hook with your host, Tom Price, is back. Take it away, Tom.
Welcome back to History's Hook. I'm Tom Price. Today we're talking about the tragedy of the Dorchester and a story of love and rediscovery between Mr. Haynes Ayres, who was a victim of the Dorchester tragedy in World War II, and perhaps his long-lost love would be Mary Jane Whiteside, Mary Jane Yeatman at the time. I'm joined by two guests, Winder Heller joining us from Bethesda, Maryland, and Mr. John Whiteside joining us from Roachport, Missouri. We were talking when we went to break about the story of the four chaplains, that incredibly heroic story. As you said, there are monuments all across the United States for the Dorchester. It got a lot of notoriety nationally. I think it was a story of heroism still fairly early in the war when the United States is still really struggling. Of course, this is before D-Day takes place. You said there are monuments in numerous states. I think there's a stained glass window in the Pentagon. A stamp was issued just after the war. This was a big story that I think most Americans probably were exposed to at some point in time. Interestingly, there was an effort to try to get the four chaplains the Medal of Honor, but because of the strict rules related to that highest honor given by the United States military, they were disqualified for that. I think it was in 1961, Congress created the Four Chaplains Medal, which was a one-time medal given by Congress to the family members of the four chaplains, which is considered one of the highest honors ever given. John, talk about your mother. You said you didn't know. She never spoke about Haynes Ayres. She was certainly aware about the Dorchester and what happened. Why do you think she never spoke about Mr. Ayres to the family?
You know, in retrospect, I think mother carried with her sadness about some of the things that had happened in her life, and certainly this would be one of them. I do know my older sister, Devan, tells a story of when she was a little girl. So this is in Columbia, Tennessee in the 50s, the 58, 59 time period. And she was in mother's closet going through her things, and she found a framed photograph of a soldier, which is my sister's description. I never saw this. And so she pulls this photograph out and she shows it to mom and says, "Who is this?" And mom said to her, it's a picture of a soldier who never came home from the war. And that was it. Hmm. But I think about mom, and I think about mom living in Columbia, Tennessee. I mean, after Haynes Ayres was killed in the North Atlantic, mother resigned or stopped. She stopped working at the bank, and she went and worked for the Red Cross in Gadsden, Alabama, as far as I know, the place to which, once again, as far as I know, she didn't really have any connection until some time later. I mean, you know, there's like, I knew that she had done those things. I mean, before we got into this, knowing these things, I knew that she had done the Red Cross thing. I knew that she had done the bank thing, but I didn't have any idea about a timeline of all of stuff. And she never talked about it. I mean, the only time she ever talked about working at the bank was to relay a funny story about one of the tellers, who is a woman, going in the bathroom, smoking a cigarette and setting the toilet seat on fire. That was all she ever said about working at the bank. You know, I think there are some things in life that are just too painful to talk about. And I think that mother, it was just like another person that mother dated. She apparently was a professional dater back then. She went out with Cecil Coondog Connor, Columbia, Tennessee, who was the natural father of Graham Parsons, the musician, remember the bird?
Sure. Yeah.
And I discovered much. I mean, Mother told me about this. She just said, "Oh, I was telling her about Graham Parsons and his connection to Columbia, Tennessee." And Mother goes, "Well, I went out with his father." But I also found out when I read a biography of Graham Parsons that his father killed himself 2 days before my 9th birthday, and he did that in Waycross, Georgia. And I'm thinking, Mother knew that. You know, I mean, it just so it adds this element to Mom, who is the warmest and most loving human being, probably whoever she's tied for first, with the most wonderful human being. And some of the weight that she carried in her life. I mean, she went in the Commerce Union Bank, and I went in the Commerce Bank with her, and she never said, "Oh, I used to work here, and this is where I was a teller, and this is where I met this man who got killed." She never said anything about that. Neither one of our parents, both of whom suffered some in the Second World War, ever talked about it. Ever. I mean, sometimes my dad would talk about it if I asked him a direct question and he felt like it. Otherwise, we could talk about anything. We just couldn't talk about that.
I think we see over and over again, and I've had the great honor of interviewing a number of World War II veterans on this show. There's a certain stoicism to that generation that they didn't want to talk about what they did. They didn't often want to talk about the suffering that they endured. Growing up, most of them during the Depression years, they went through some pretty serious tragedy throughout their life. And I think they've been pretty reticent to talk about those kinds of things. So I'm not terribly surprised by that. As I said, I had the honor of knowing your mother as well. I agree. She was incredibly warm and kind and generous. And it's been a wonderful experience for me as this story has sort of unfolded, as you both have done your research and allowed me to be a part of it as well, to learn a little bit more about her life and a little bit more about the history of this place, this amazing crossroads community in Middle Tennessee that seems to connect to history all over the world. It's incredibly unique.
One thing that I think also that I ought to throw in here, because this is just so incredible. I think the Ayers family, or the Harriet, she ended up living in Kinston, North Carolina. She married a guy named Smith, and they lived in Kinston, as I recall. Anyway, I used to work at Camp Seagull in the summers. I was trying to avoid getting a real job, so I was a camp counselor. And when I was a teenager, and in 1969, which was the year after, that was the summer after my first year of college, I was working as a counselor at Camp Seagull near New Bern, North Carolina. And Mother sends me this letter. So this is now 26 years after Haynes Ayers passed away. And Mother says, "I have a friend in North Carolina," who in retrospect was Harriet Smith. And she has a daughter who's about your age, and I would like for you to meet her. So, okay, Mom, yeah. And so it was arranged by the mothers, mine and Ayers, for us to meet on a day off that I had at camp. And we went over to Atlantic Beach, and as I recall, we maybe went to the sanitary fish market and ate there and so forth. And so I meet this girl named Ayers Smith. And so when I was talking to Winder on the telephone, because of the name Ayers, which was the way that it was spelled and within my experience, it was a name that stuck in my mind. So I said to Winder, I met this girl named Ayers Smith, who was either 17 or 18 at the time. And I was wondering if that has any connection to you. And the answer was yes. It's Haynes' sister's daughter.
Yes. Let me pick that up from that point for a second, John, because I love that story. And I've told it countless times to people. And what I love about it is this happened now 52 or 53 years ago. Right. And so I asked John, and he may have seen Ayers Smith twice in this summer. And I said, "How do you remember exactly what you did on these 2 days when you were together?" And he said, "Well, she was a really good-looking young woman." And I just loved that. And I couldn't wait to kid my first cousin, Ayers, about it.
Right.
And John and Ayer Smith have talked on the phone as well, which I love.
Yeah. The circles do close, don't they?
They
yeah.
do.
What it was is that this was certainly a huge tragedy for the Ayers family. My mother could barely speak of it 10 years later when I was growing up. And my brothers would say my grandmother was never the quite the same happy person she was that they remembered in early years. And it's a tragedy that I'm glad to know that who people were, who Mary Jane Yateman was, and to meet John by phone. We'll hopefully meet soon in Columbia and get together and with some other war stories.
Yeah, we'll call Father Tom Price at the archive.
I hope you will. Right. I hope you will. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We could spend a lot more time unpacking this amazing story. Winder Heller, John Whiteside, thank you so much for spending an hour with us on History's Hook. I end the show with a quote from Gerhard Busch. He was U-223's first officer on that fateful night. Busch spoke at the Four Chaplains Foundation's 60th anniversary ceremony in 2000, regretting the pain he had inflicted during the war. He had this to say, "We ought to love when others hate. We can bring faith where doubt threatens. We can awaken hope where despair exists. We can light up the light where darkness reigns. We can bring joy where sorrow dominates." Those words, as well as any, represent the lessons of the Four Chaplains and the Dorchester and our never-forgotten friend now, Haynes Ayers. You can now hear all of our History's Hook episodes online at frontporchradiotn.com and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week, won't you, as we connect the history in your backyard to the world on another edition of History's Hook.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of History's Hook with your host, Tom Price. We hope you enjoyed today's show. Be sure to join us every Saturday at 9 a.m. and again at 6 p.m. right here on WKOM 101.7 FM for a journey through time.
Every morning, I park my car across the street from my business, and I can't wait to get in there. That's pretty common for small business owners. We have the added satisfaction, however, of guiding hundreds of families with their retirement, education, savings, and general investments. We're a locally owned business that tries very hard to simplify a complicated world. This is Monty Sneed from Caledonian Financial in historic downtown Columbia.
Securities and investment advisory services offered through NBC Securities Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC. Columbia Foodland is a locally owned and operated family grocery store with a full line of dry, dairy, frozen, meat, and produce items. We focus on keeping the freshest hand-cut meat and produce items daily with the most competitive prices in town. We offer weekly ad specials as well as in-store weekly specials throughout the store. Located at 427 West 7th Street in Columbia in the former Harris Foodland location. Columbia Foodland. We are here and ready to serve the wonderful people of Columbia and the surrounding areas.
Hello, my name is Connor Mims. My wife Bradley and I live in Columbia, Tennessee in Riverside. I am a deck and porch builder and my wife is a second grade teacher at Riverside Elementary. My specialty is designing and building elegant and comfortable porches and decks. Let me work with you to design and build the porch or deck of your dreams. Give us a call today from our website, MimsModernLandscape.com. That's MimsModernLandscape.com and check out what we have to offer. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Matt Perales, manager of Murray County Equipment. We help you with all your agriculture and construction equipment needs. We carry a full line of New Holland tractors from compacts to high horsepower. We have a full line of Gravely mowing equipment. We also have New Holland construction equipment, attachments, and accessories for your tractors and a complete parts department. We are locally owned and operated. Come see us at 1075 North James Campbell Boulevard or learn about us on Facebook or contact us at 931-490-8183.
Attention, ladies and gentlemen, flight 777 to Funtown with continued service to Wintersville is ready to board. Please make sure you have your new instant game tickets from the Tennessee Lottery in hand, and thank you for choosing game-changing fun.
With chances to win up to $500,000, you'll be flying first class to cash prizes with our new instant games. Hurry to your nearest Tennessee Lottery retailer to get on board today. Only from the Tennessee Lottery. Please play responsibly. Pick a number between 0 and 9. That's right. Now pick another one. Right again. Now pick one more.
Wow, you're on a roll. Now, if you only would have played them. Play your lucky numbers today with 3 daily drawings and top prizes of $500 to $5,000. And add Wild Ball for more winning combos. Cash 3 and Cash 4, only from the Tennessee Lottery. Game-changing moolah making fun. Please play responsibly.
This is Tripp Stoltz with Columbia Ace Hardware. I love listening to 101.7 WKOM FM, Columbia, Tennessee.